content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, You've Never Seen a Star Like This, by Marina Corin. From our perspective down here, on the surface of our planet, the stars are tiny gleaming specks of inky dark universe. Occasionally they appear to twinkle when the air in our atmosphere bends the incoming light. Through telescopes they are balls of light, their glow distorted by the lens. And up close, the best star in the universe, our sun, is an orangey sphere of flame. But stars can be so much more than that, as telescopes, especially the very good ones, can reveal. The James Webb Space Telescope, the most powerful space observatory ever built, perched 1,000,000 miles from Earth, has captured a portrait of a star about 1,000 light-years away. It's not a diamond hanging in the sky, but a velvety dark orb suspended in space with jets of bright material unfurling on two sides like the long shimmery wings of an insect. Stars twinkle, yes, but they can also illuminate the darkness in ways utterly unlike anything we're used to. The star in the image is a newborn in stellar terms, also called a protostar. Stars have lifespans of their own. They are young, they grow up, they grow old. When they are infants, freshly ignited from clumps of cold gas and dust that have collapsed under their own gravity, they can absorb the leftover material from their formation and eject some of it in pairs of narrow jets. The gush smashes into the surrounding interstellar gas and dust, and the constant collisions produce those radiant wings. The new picture is a result of the Webb telescope's capacity to study the universe in, quite literally, a new light. In the beginning, protostars are encased in the dusty molecular cloud of their formation, a cocoon of almost visible light that almost visible light can't pierce. If you looked at the baby star with the naked eye, or even a different kind of telescope, you'd just see a sparkly, opaque cloud of stardust. But Webb is specifically designed to detect infrared light, which is invisible to the human eye, but can pass through such dust. By absorbing the infrared light emitted from the excited molecules within the outflows, the Webb telescope was able to capture their structure in mesmerizing detail. Astronomers have observed the outflows of protostars before, and they have a good understanding of the swirling chaos, but to witness such richness and texture is another experience. It scrambles our familiar understanding of what stars, those beautiful pinpricks that follow us around at night, can be. The newest image reminds me of Webb's observations of Neptune and Uranus, which look so different from previous pictures. Suddenly, the outer planets are not dull gray and blue, but incandescent, each with a set of beautiful rings. The strange-looking star recorded by Webb is a vision of our cosmic past. This is the very likely what our sun looked like when it was just a few tens of thousands of years old, with only 8% of the mass it has today. Our sun is now about 4.6 billion years old, and it will remain its usual shining self for another 5 billion years or so, no giant pair of jet streams to be found. This distant object will eventually become a sun-like star, or even two. Certain wiggles in the outflows suggest the presence of a pair of baby stars, according to NASA and the European Space Agency. Many stars exist in this arrangement as binary pairs, gravitationally bound to each other. Some stars even come in triples. The nearest star system to us, about 4.3 light-years away, consists of a trio of stars orbiting together, two sun-like stars and one dimmer, cooler one. We can't predict what kind of system will take shape around this newborn star, or stars, but there might be enough cosmic bits and pieces left over to form planets. Maybe this spot in the universe will someday spark a simple form of life into being, and nourish it for eons the way it happened here, long enough for a few bits of inhabitants to invent nearly magical tools to explore the depths. Perhaps the effort will prompt them to rethink the cosmos in the way we are now. Our next article from the Atlantic's Ideas section, What Happened to Empathy? By Xochitl Gonzalez. San Francisco, I realized during a visit to the city this spring, has a people problem. Not a homeless people problem or a tech people problem, but a lack of people problem. As I walked from my hotel in Soma to the Embarcadero on a sunny afternoon, the emptiness of the streets felt nearly apocalyptic. Passing other humans, a fundamental circumstance of urban life elsewhere, here was so rare it felt oddly menacing. I did pass some people who looked unwell or dirty from living on the streets, but that's not why I felt the way I did. The volume and density of humanity living on the streets are what make cities feel safe. The pleasure and pain of a city is that we are never alone, even when we desperately want to be. That wasn't the case in San Francisco. So I was bewildered recently when I read of the city's experiment with driverless taxicabs. During that visit, I stepped over two people who appeared to be high on fentanyl, stepped past too many boarded-up storefronts to count, and literally stepped into human excrement. Engaging with my living, breathing, and sometimes chatty taxi and Uber drivers was absolutely the least of my troubles in San Francisco. Why did a city of such terrible solitude need driverless taxis? For whom were taxi drivers such a horrific nuisance that they were worth eradicating an entire profession of working-class people that has existed since the earliest days of the automobile? When did we decide that engagement with our fellow man was a bug and not a feature of our short and limited lives? I was about to turn 24 and just settling into my adult life in New York City when the planes went into the Twin Towers on that perfectly crisp September day. I huddled in tears with my coworkers before I walked home and huddled in tears with my roommate. Not out of fear as much as pure shock and deep empathy. Nearly 3,000 people killed while they were just trying to do their jobs. My fellows and I didn't know any of them, but they all felt very knowable. The busser at Windows on the World, the secretary from Staten Island, the trader who'd gone to your college, the fireman from Sunset Park. We were afraid to get on the subway, but we'd walk or drive or ride on buses to sit around one another's houses and apartments. Anything to not be alone while mourning people who were strangers but not strangers at all. When it was time to go back to normal, no one really was sure how. It all felt too soon. No memorial, no light display was enough to allay the pain. And yet we tried. We needed to at least try. 20 years later, another disaster. It didn't come on as suddenly as the crash of a commandeered plane, but it was fast for a plague. It took with it not thousands of American lives, but more than 1 million, and 7 million lives worldwide. Unlike with 9/11, most everyone knows personally someone who has suffered a COVID loss. And yet, this time, there has been no real attempt at a moment of national mourning. We not only didn't grieve, we seemed to resent missing even a beat of our attempt to get back to normal. We can blame government or capitalism or any number of things, but it's hard not to see this as reflective of a social shift, a collective reduction in empathy. This shouldn't be surprising. Empathy is cultivated through interactions with people we don't know well, those glimpses into other interior worlds. We have, over the past 2 decades, slowly and then quickly optimized other people out of our lives. One app at a time, we've greatly reduced our need to casually engage with anyone we don't know, or even to meaningfully engage with those we do. I sometimes consider all of the people I might have engaged with on a typical day just 5 years ago. I would head to work on the subway, grab a coffee, and chat with the barista or Bodegaro, get to the office and gossip with my coworkers about their lives. At lunch, I might make small talk while waiting for my salad, then pop into my favorite clothing or shoe store and trade some banter or get some inspiration from the shop clerks. After work, I might stop at the bookstore and pick up a novel, then have a drink at my local bar while I waited for my takeout to be ready. At home, I'd call a friend before bed. On the weekends, I'd drop my laundry at my wash and fold and ask how the owner's kids were doing. I'd see the same people at my weekly yoga class, meet a friend at the movies, or browse the flea market. At night, we'd go to a bar and flirt with a bartender. Everywhere I went, there was small talk, and often random, weird interactions, and sometimes long and meaningful ones. I won't run through every app that has changed this, but suffice it to say, no one needs to go to an office to chit-chat anymore when you can just Zoom all day long. Someone can pick up and drop off our laundry, or our takeout, or our books, or our new clothing purchases without us even seeing the person doing it, let alone speaking with them. We can stream our workouts and movies. And we have accepted this erasure without ever asking whether it is a good thing, without ever examining not just how the jobs lost by humans to algorithms might affect the economy, but how those lost interactions might affect our humanity. We are a people made miserable. This is an opinion that isn't. Americans have fewer friends than we used to. Women are drinking more, and men are lonelier. Our kids are sad, too. We are pessimistic about our country and about the state of the world. Maybe only our pets are happy. We are well informed about the ways in which our spirits are struggling and somewhat informed as to the reasons why. Americans who frequently use social media have been found to display reduced empathy and increased narcissism. Depression has been linked to the use of dating apps and binging TV alone. What if our suffering is not just internal, but social? What if the human race has deteriorated? What if we are determined because we've begun to resent, we've deteriorated because we've begun to resent not only human interactions, but humans, period? More and more, we're inured to suffering and death. Many think pieces have been written about why Americans won't act to stop endless mass shootings and overdoses and killings of black people by cops. What if the inertia is a result of us simply no longer valuing human life the way we once did? This is a dark premise, yet one that, scrolling through social media since this weekend's terrorist attack on Israeli civilians, I've had to seriously entertain. How else to explain the process by which someone can watch videos of slaughtered human beings and then post messages of casual cruelty? Instead of praying for the victims and empathizing with their loved ones, in Israel and in Gaza for that matter, people are raising a virtual middle finger at their pain because of politics, because of revolution. This is hardly the first time I've questioned American empathy. I feel this way each time someone says, "All lives matter," after an innocent black American is shot by a cop. I feel this way whenever I see people cheering legislation that makes trans youth fear using a bathroom or just trying to be comfortable in who they are. I question our empathy every time someone starts talking about the Second Amendment within hours of a shooting at a school or mall or grocery store. I feel this way whenever I see elected officials wishing ill health or death on their political enemies. How emotionally healthy are we as a people when in moments of profound and painful tragedy, we feel compelled to insert our political opinions or policy positions? Can we not, just for a moment, feel for the victims? Despite how divided we are politically and how abhorrent I find some of the views espoused in this nation, I don't believe that America has a people problem. We, like San Francisco, have a lack of people problem. We have manicured out of our lives and our feeds and our day-to-day existence the need for any and all interactions with anyone who has not been handpicked by us, who is not of the same class or race or political position. We have found more and more ways to avoid engaging with others of our species, and in doing so, we have eroded our empathy. This is not a call to abandon technology or close our social media accounts. It's too late for that. But we can attempt to turn away from indifference and re-embrace humanity, to pull ourselves out of our cocoons of digital isolation. We can pick up the phone and call a friend instead of liking a post on Instagram. We can ask a coworker to get coffee and express curiosity about their life. We can, believe it or not, make small talk while waiting for our takeout. The people we meet and what we learn from them might not only surprise us, it might also save us. From the Atlantic's Science Department, Hiking Needs New Rules by Christine Peterson. Nestled among the Rocky Mountains is a yawning stretch of sagebrush, granite rocks, and flowing hills near Gunnison, Colorado, is the Hartman Rocks Recreation Area, one of the first spots to clear of snow in the spring, which means that it is one of the first spots to give cooped-up humans a place to stretch their legs and fill their lungs to ride their bikes. Unfortunately for the Gunnison sage grouse, the seasonal rhythms that send cyclists outside coincide with the rhythms that make the birds start fanning and strutting like little brown peacocks in a bid to reproduce. Back in the early 2000s, they were stuck flaunting their strange mating dance amid Hartman Rock's ever more popular trail system. And so the Bureau of Land Management decided to limit spring disturbances such as motor and mountain biking. To balance the needs of bikers and birds, the agency posted signs telling riders to stay out of one portion of the trails, at least from March 15th to May 15th. As far as human activities goes, outdoor recreation has seemed relatively benign in its impacts compared with building a subdivision, oil and gas field, or a shopping center. But researchers are beginning to understand that it's causing distress to wildlife all over the country. Today in the West, where some of the fastest growing states contain some of the largest tracts of federal public land, bighorn sheep burn calories avoiding backcountry skiers. Elk have a harder time raising their calves around cyclists and hikers, and grizzly bears appear to miss important meals because of looky-loos. These problems exist precisely because the ways we connect with the planet, hiking, biking, trail running, skiing, climbing, put us in such close proximity to other animals in some of the few spaces they now have left to roam. Being outside benefits us and benefits the outdoors. Love the mountains, and you're more likely to support biodiversity conservation and other pro-environmental efforts. But the wildlife we've pushed into nature's corners is starting to bear the brunt of all that love. If we can be really smart about it, I think we can continue to enjoy the wildlife that we do, said David Weens, the executive director of International Mountain Bicycling Association, which has worked on hundreds of trail-building projects across the globe. Being smart, he told me, requires restricting ourselves in certain places during certain parts of the year, where and when the well-being of wildlife depends on it. That would mean accepting new norms for even the lightest uses of this country's more wild spaces, and at the same time recognizing just how many places we can still visit. I've spent more than a decade as a journalist encouraging, cajoling, and even demanding that people just go outside. I follow my own advice. Someone asked me after a recent backpacking trip how many nights my young daughter has slept in a tent. I realized the answer was roughly a year, or about a seventh of her life. Camping, hiking, hunting, fishing, and otherwise existing outside of cities and towns can be sources of solace, peace, and connection to our place on Earth. We want her to be able to identify an elk track as easily as she can identify Frozen's Elsa. Because elk are a part of her world, one we want her to understand, to love, to eventually protect. This idea is fundamental to the concept of natural spaces in the United States. More than a century ago, after settlers had run roughshod over the nation's forests, grasslands, and prairies, environmentalists began arguing that the country needed a constituency for the outdoors. After national leaders began carving spaces for wildlife, nature's new constituents flocked outside and by using these places learned to love and protect them. Over time, the tracts of land managed by federal agencies became massive playgrounds, used all the more during the coronavirus pandemic. BLM land clocked 81 million visits in 2022, a jump of 10 million from just 3 years before, and about a 40% increase over 2012. Visits to the national forests and wilderness areas, too, have increased by 18 million from 2019 to 2020. Not every glimpse of an elk or grizzly bear in every location is disrupting the creature's natural rhythms. Take lynx. Studies in some of the most ski-heavy areas of Colorado show that as long as skiers stay on predictable trails in relatively open areas, they don't bother the wild cats all that much, John Squires, a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station in Missoula, Montana, told me. Contrast that with grizzly bears who scarf ants as readily as they take down elk calves. Some bears in Wyoming and Montana flock to high talus slopes to munch on high-calorie moths in the summer. The moths can provide up to a third of the calories the bear needs to build fat for winter. But if people hike up near those sites, as quiet as they may be, bears often leave, Frank Van Manen, leader of the U.S. Geological Survey's interagency grizzly bear study team, told me. He doesn't know yet the toll these moves take, but every day spent avoiding humans is another day not preparing for winter. Most of these brushes of people spooking bighorn sheep, elk, or deer fall into the grizzly bear category. Almost 60% of wildlife interactions with outdoor recreation are negative, according to a 2016 study of 274 scientific papers. Although the review authors acknowledge the research is limited, that finding would mean that more than half of species recreationist interactions, animals become more vigilant, excuse me, move somewhere else or stop eating, which over time can result in fewer babies, lower fat reserves, and even death. But knowing we have an impact doesn't mean we know its extent or the solutions for varied species over an even more varied landscape. Kathy Zeller, a researcher with the Aldo Leopold Wilderness Research Institute at the Rocky Mountain Research Station, told me. She and Mark Dittmer, a fellow biologist at the same research station, are studying the effects of biking and hiking sounds on wildlife. They know the sounds change how deer, bears, moose, and other wildlife behave, but not if those animals can tolerate those changes and still survive and reproduce. Belief in America's boundless plenty has caught up with this country before. Back when tens of millions of bison roamed its expanses, along with millions of bighorn sheep, elk, pronghorn, deer, and countless other species, wild animals seemed endless, until they weren't. By the early 1900s, those species' numbers were dwindling, some with populations in the tens of thousands, as a result of market hunting, meat hunting, railroad expansion, and environmental warfare against Native Americans. The answer wasn't to stop hunting forever. Hunters began backing license fees, supporting state agencies that managed wildlife, and seasons regulating how many animals were killed in what places. The answer was limitations. Hunters became crucial advocates for maintaining some of America's wildlife. Unlike hunting, other outdoor recreation doesn't rely on wildlife. Still, seeing a moose or bighorn sheep while hiking, or a fox or bald eagle while mountain biking, is part of what separates the experience from biking in a city or spinning on a Peloton. It helps transform these spaces that we use into spaces that we love. The answer, again, could be limitations targeted to each species and area. Some trails used in high-use places such as national parks and rafting trips down rivers already rely on permitting to manage use. More sites could start. Restrictions could last for full seasons, or only for certain hours of the day. By mid-morning, some animals, such as sage-grouse, are often already done mating. Getting used to the idea of limitations can take time. In Colorado at first, those edicts to keep mountain biking pressure off the sage-grouse went largely unheeded. But Weens found that when mountain bikers understood why they were supposed to keep out, eventually they did. He understands the need to ride. He's in the Mountain Bike Hall of Fame, and his wife, Susan DeMatte, won an Olympic bronze medal for mountain biking. In 2006, he formed a local organization called Gunnison Trails to provide order and funding to often haphazardly built trails. He then realized that the new association could rally its own to follow the rules. Rules require adjustments, sure. We just want to go for a hike and let our dogs run. We want to camp and play and not worry if we're harming a bird we might never see. But we're sharing those spaces with humans and wildlife alike. There will always be places we can ride, too. The other 75% of the Hartman Rocks trails aren't closed in the spring. Better understanding how we're affecting other creatures also means that we better know which area hosts animals that are less sensitive to human presence, or which times of year or even times of day were least disruptive. We can advocate for conservation and still go hiking, skiing, and biking. We can also put our dogs on leashes and heed signs erected by land managers, because if we want wildlife to be there too, we might need to accept that the outdoors can't be open everyone all the time. Now, an Ode to Fallibility by James Parker. December 2019, Norwich, England. Floodlit winter brilliance, scintillating figures with dragon breath, some in yellow, some in blue. Norwich City is playing Tottenham Hotspur in the Premier League. Timu Pukki, Norwich's fiercely scurrying Finnish striker, receives or magnetically attracts a long searching ball from Mario Vranjic onto his chest, angles it into his own path, and then, slicing between two Tottenham defenders, zeroes it past a scrambling goalkeeper and into the back of the net. Beautiful. The goal scorer wheels away in triumph. The home crowd goes nuts. Shazam! A lightning ripple of sports-induced gladness zips around the world. But wait, hang on. Oh, Christ. VAR, the video assistant referee system, reviled innovation of the current Premier League season, is checking the goal. 150 miles away in London, footage is being reviewed, where in limbo, a vacuum occupies the broadcast booth. The crowd shifts, grumbles, in a haze of spoiling endorphins. Then on the big screen, there it is. Goal disallowed. A haggard roar goes up. It has been determined that Pukki, at a moment that Vranjic sent the ball his way, was microscopically, with perhaps the outer edge of his shoulder, ahead of the deepest-lying Spurs defender. In other words, he was offside. The referee didn't see it. The linesman didn't see it. The crowd didn't see it. The Tottenham players didn't see it. Nobody saw it. But the faceless invigilators of VAR, in their multi-screen hive, they saw it. Sorry, Pukki. Sorry, universe. Wind back up this bowl of joy. No goal. As for the Pukki decision, it might have been, in the narrowest and most metrical sense, right. But everything else about it is wrong. The second guessing, the flow reversal, the sheer bummer of the process, the VAR world with its obscure vectors and subatomic infringements is just not what soccer is, not what reality is. So here's to being fallible. You don't hit pause and summon the immaculate arbitrators. You don't wait for the screen to tell you what happened. You don't stop the game until the game is over. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind.